Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the first hour. I first and foremost want to thank everybody for tuning in this weekend, and I also want to direct all of our listeners who listen on the radio and on the podcast, or just tune into our website during the weekend. I highly recommend going back over this last week's bunch of interviews. I had a couple new guests on the show and a couple favorites that I think had some very interesting comments on a week that was relatively slow or had lacked volatility, at least until the end of the week. I am kicking off this show with Chris Temple, regular guest on our show, founder and editor of The National Investor. And Chris, let's get a quick comment on copper on Friday, breaking out of this short-term resistance that it was bumping its head against. I have to ask you, is this all simply because we're getting some trade talk rumors that there might be some deal or at least a memorandum of understanding between China and the U.S.?
Well, as part of it, as you and I are recording this, of course, we don't know what the outcome of the Friday afternoon meeting is between President Trump and the special envoy of President Xi from China, Mr. Liu. We don't know how that's going to turn out Friday afternoon, whether they actually are going to come out with what's been rumored for the last 24 hours or so, this six-part memorandum of understanding. But I have to tell you, Corey, if copper is going up based on that, that's insufficient reason in my view, among other things. And you and I talked about this in a couple of our segments earlier this week, as you just mentioned. I've been writing about it previously. In the month of January alone, China threw close to $400 billion into its credit system. That is beyond anything any individual central bank pretty much has done. And all they've done is slow the rot of an economy in their country that is choking on such mountains of debt relative to the size of its economy more than anybody on this planet these days. And they have to print all this money just to maintain equilibrium. So it makes you wonder, if we get even a framework of a trade deal, how much does that really translate in the real world into China being able to again amp things up and become the overwhelming consumer of copper and all these other commodities in the world? I think people are ahead of themselves. So the one reason I think that copper would be legitimate in breaking out, and the reason why the stock market may be doing better than I certainly expected this rally to do and everything else, is because the markets are starting to sense, and I think correctly so, that the central banks are not going to wait for another 2008 style crash. They're going to start getting back to full on inflate or die mode now in the hopes of heading it off. I mean, the stuff that has come out of the Fed in the last month and a half or so is astonishing, including this week from New York Fed President John Williams.
Now, one thing that we have been talking about on this track of the Fed becoming more dovish, even though, you know what, they're at least, well, it was a bit of a surprise that they got just as dovish in that full-on pause that they have now been in for a month. But the fact of the matter is they are starting to understand something that you've said, that the Fed is the de facto central bank of the world, and they're finally starting to understand that if they see weakness in these other countries, which no doubt they have, in the major countries like China and Europe, then they might try to get ahead of it. Have we ever seen central banks try to get ahead of a recession? We usually hear about central banks leading us into recessions.
They usually do. They step on the gas too much, and then when they try and gently take away the punch bowl, it becomes abrupt. The one time in recent history, you go back to the middle 1980s, and the U.S. dollar had gone into orbit for a variety of reasons. It was causing all kinds of trouble. It was causing commodity price weakness, as a strong dollar will do internationally, etc. And it wasn't so much the central banks, but it was the treasury officials of the leading nations got together for what was called the Plaza Accord back then. And you had this basically multifaceted, concerted manipulation back downward of the dollar, which had become too strong. That, of course, ended up being overdone. And then the dollar started to weaken, and that led to the Fed having to reverse and raise interest rates, and that caused the 1987 stock market crash ultimately. But the Plaza Court is the only time you ever saw policymakers try and short circuit something, you know, maybe a little bit on the order of what we got. But even saying that, Corey, this is a different kettle of fish. You've got, and I've said this to you more than once, you have to look at everything that we talk about now, even these trade things, which frankly, in the grand scheme of things, are a sidebar to the big picture. The big picture, the core story that people need to keep their heads around, is that we have had a decade of unprecedented monetary stimulus, quantitative easing the planet over, zero interest rates, negative interest rates, etc., that helped to rescue us supposedly from the 2008 crash. We got a lot more traction in reblowing various asset bubbles and blowing some new ones than we did for most people where the Main Street economy is concerned, but it's all kind of pretty much run its course. And it's why the Fed had to do such an about face in its policy, because they realized that things are that over choked with debt again, that they can't normalize to the extent that they thought they could maybe 6 months or a year ago. And so now we're left with this notion that to keep us, forget about rescuing us, Corey, from another crash, to keep us from going into a new one, you've got the European Central Bank that has abandoned any thought of its trying to normalize policy. It's through the back door, through its open market operations, still net doing a lot of quantitative easing. Kuroda from the Bank of Japan came out this week and said, hey, we might have to rejoin this too. We might be actually printing more money and buying more assets. I don't know what there is left to buy over there, but they'll figure it out. And last but not least, after already having such an abrupt change of policy, you're right on the in the aftermath of that, getting comments from a key person like a John Williams that the Fed is going to dust off some of its old ideas itself on what might bring about negative interest rates here in the U.S. when the time comes. They are still concerned that their measures of inflation are still stuck in the mud. They don't want that. They want to be able to create more inflation. They've done a lot of it in asset markets, but not the way they want. So you're going to see the Fed, even before we actually have a full-blown recession, country, they will reverse course. They will start easing in various ways. And though I think copper has a little bit of justification, that's why you've especially seen the strong rally in gold of late, why interest rates stay compressed, it's because people are starting to figure out that in order to keep everything from imploding again, these central banks are all in one way or another going back to what the late Richard Russell has called the inflate or die mode.
Okay, so on that point, if we do get more money printing out of all of these central banks, one, does it lead to inflation? And two, does it, again, just end up in financial assets?
Well, the kind of answers itself, Corey, because both of those choices are really one and the same. They, of course, come hell or high water, they don't want financial assets to deflate, because then that compromises the banking and financial system and markets themselves. Secondarily, of course, the Main Street economy. So the kind of inflation they will create will be maybe in commodity prices a bit more now going forward than what we have seen in the recent past. We've had this chronic underperformance for years in commodities compared to financial assets. That gap will close some. I think in the time ahead, it's this stagflation light environment I've been talking about. But still, people who are going to predict, and they are now, that as the Fed gets back into this, you know, just like they predicted back in 2008, 2009, and 10, gold's going to $5,000. We're going to have Germany or Venezuela or Zimbabwe-like hyperinflation because of all this money printing. We won't see that, at least certainly not here, and really in much of the rest of the developed world. What you have to keep in mind, folks, is that all of this money printing by the central banks, for the most part, is simply going to mitigate the deflation that is already starting to unfold within the markets and within economies. They just want to get an earlier start on it than they did in 2008 when it hit them all at once.
Yeah, crazy that they could be getting that far in front of a recession. But hey, that would be a change in what central banks have done in the past. Just to wrap us up with a quick comment regarding China. You and I have talked about how if some of these trade war deals come about, that would, you would think, only hurt China in terms of what they would have to concede to the U.S. Plus, if they're struggling that much, does even this money printing, which they need to print more and more to get less and less of an effect, does that even save China, or is China just in that much trouble?
China is in a lot of trouble, and people that follow it closely know this. The president of the United States knows this, which is why he has really prosecuted this trade war to the extent that he has, believing that China is more vulnerable than the U.S., and they want to force China into several behavioral changes, as Wilbur Ross has termed it, while we have the advantage. But again, when you consider, and I've got a chart on this in my current issue, it's really scary if you think that you need to be a full-on commodity bull. You know, and I agree with all of the long-term views on base metals, especially copper, the growth of the green economy in years to come, the industrialization of a lot of the still developing world in years to come is extraordinarily bullish for copper going forward. There's no question about that. But the problem is, when at the present time, China still represents the biggest factor that the markets look at when it comes to commodity pricing. If China can't keep all the balls in the air, or let's say we get some kind of a cockamamie actual trade deal, which on most issues still kicks the can down the road, and you get a little bit of a relief rally or a little bit more of a blow off top in some of these rallies, whether for stocks or commodities or whatnot, reality sets back in. China has, you know, it's the equivalent, Corey, of going out to dinner and you eat the equivalent of 10 people's meals for supper, and people expect you can repeat that performance again because you did it last night. You can't do it. You got to digest what you ate. Well, you might get sick. You might end up in a hospital. You might bust your gut open. And that, for to a great extent, is a position that China has been in. And the reason they have slowed down in their economy is they're trying to figure out how to digest all this, trying to figure out how to keep enough debts from going bad that it doesn't bring everything down. And, you know, again, long term, I love copper. I love a lot of these other stories. Near term, I think that people have got a little bit too simplistic a view of just how these various assets are not only going to be rescued, but be able to extend their rallies based just on this.
All right, Chris. Always good comments. And you outline a scenario that I think some people have not accepted yet and still believe that the Fed might go down and get a couple more rate hikes in. I'm very much on the fence, but talking with you day after day, I do very much see where you stand and why you stand on what the central banks are going to have to do and what they might do getting ahead of.
Let me add this. This time last year, I made a prediction that long-term interest rates would peak in 2018, right?
I remember that.
And they did. I'm going to make a prediction now. You will not see further rate hikes in this cycle from the Fed. Write it down.
All right. The rate is written
down. You will not. I'm not on a fence.
Okay. I know you're not on the fence, but hey, you're getting me more onto your side. But it's an interesting back and forth. And that is going to, I believe, just dominate 2019, as in what the Fed is going to do, or if they're just going to remain on pause, or if they're even going to start printing money. Chris, it's great having you on the show. I appreciate the comments for the weekend show. Everybody stick around. I'm going to be right back with Mike Larson, continuing to focus on the U.S. equity markets.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.